From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the dispute between Netflix and movie theater owners continues, and this time it's Martin Scorsese who's caught in the middle. Then John Leguizamo has an Emmy nomination for When They See Us, and his stage show Latin History for Morons won a Tony. He says both projects challenge flawed historical narratives.
And if the correct history was put out there, that Latin and Black people were really instrumental in the making of the United States, then there would be a lot more respect to us. And people would not be so bold as to, you know, tell us to go back to where we came from.
All that coming up on The Frame. Martin Scorsese's big-budget Netflix film The Irishman will debut November 1st in theaters, but on a lot fewer screens than Netflix had hoped. Theater owners want to retain their long window of exclusivity, typically about 3 months before a movie begins streaming. Rather than a national release, The Irishman will now debut in a handful of smaller chains, some independent theaters, and others that Netflix will rent. Ann Thompson is editor-at-large for the digital news site IndieWire, and she says that even if the streaming company hasn't won the war with theater owners, they now have competing studios joining the battle.
I mean, remember where we were around the Oscars and Steven Spielberg and Green Book and Netflix was the enemy and all the distributors were sort of freaked out. Right now, there's a different shift. The real enemy is Disney. It's not Netflix is on the ropes, right? And they're trying to work with the theater chains. And in a way, the studios are supporting them now. They're letting Netflix be the disruptor in a good way, trying to find some place where they can meet. But I didn't think they were going to pull this off, and they didn't.
Yeah, Disney, like Netflix, is launching a major streaming initiative, and so are other studios like Universal. And I think those studios also want to see this three-month window shrunken. What is the upside for a company like Netflix to have a movie like The Irishman play in theaters? Is it a financial reward, more of a prestige reward? What's the benefit?
They have a number of different issues. One is that they have a filmmaker, Martin Scorsese, who, by the way, was not going to get this money from anyone else. I mean, the reported figure is $175 million. It's probably closer to $200. And Netflix can afford it, I guess. What their real end game is getting people to watch the service. But why they're throwing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 other films out during this period. Why? For the filmmakers to give them a theatrical showing, to brand the titles, to give them some marketing and reviews and some kind of identification so that they will do better when they're on Netflix. I will never forget the producer who said to me, nothing beats 3 weeks of word of mouth in a theater, and that's still true.
Yeah, I think if we had the actual voting numbers, we would see that Roma probably lost to Green Book by about a dozen votes in the Best Picture race. And you and I think talked to Oscar voters who might have penalized Roma for not being what we would call a traditional theatrical release. So is that part of Netflix's thinking?
Yes, it adds cred, but it's also about the Oscar race, as you mentioned. Roma did well. It got 3 Oscars. It was in the Best Picture race, and it was in theaters for about 3 months, which a lot of people forget. And it was a singularly cinematic experience. And Alfonso Cuarón was a studio filmmaker, already well respected within the Hollywood community. So that was an anomaly in many ways. Irishman, they have to want to get some of their money back. They want to build cred. They want to be in the Oscar race, and they want it to be taken seriously. And that's why they're in theaters.
Earlier this year, I, like you, was at the CinemaCon convention in Las Vegas, which is an annual gathering of movie theater owners. And I sat down with John Fithian, who is the head of the National Association of Theater Owners. And I asked him about windows, how much time goes between a movie premiering in theaters and when it appears on a streaming service. And here's what he had to say.
There's a misperception often reported that there's a fixed 90-day window in the domestic marketplace. That's really an average. And there are ranges of windows from like 70 days to 120 in movies being released theatrically today based on the type of movie.
It doesn't feel, though, that the exhibitors are really that interested in shrinking those windows. So how is this story going to play out? If it's not over The Irishman, is there going to be a movie in the near future that theater owners want that still could be on some platform, maybe Netflix, maybe Disney Plus, where they're going to have to give a little.
Yeah, I think the theaters are being really foolish, but I understand that they're also frightened and they have shareholders. And I think they're afraid that if they back down and say 70 days, I believe 70 days was a real figure they might have considered with Stuber. He wouldn't, though. He wanted something, as I understand it, closer to 45. And 45 was a place they weren't willing to go. So remember that the theaters share the gross with the studios. And so the studios really, really, really want their marketing dollars to help with these streaming platforms and not have this long gap between when a movie leaves the theaters and shows up somewhere else.
How would tiered pricing, which is different fees for different kinds of movies, depending on, I guess, their quality and how long they've been in theaters, how would that affect a movie like The Irishman?
This isn't going to happen anytime soon. The event movie gets a bigger price than the little indie. I just don't see it happening. The theaters really don't like this one. But what could happen is something else where they let a movie like that play for a certain period of time with a different kind of split, and everybody's happy. And I think that one might work.
Yeah, at least you can get up and go to the restroom without bothering a lot of people. But I think it matters where you see a film. And a movie like The Irishman, just like a movie like Roma, I really believe need to be seen in a theater to appreciate the quality of the overall filmmaking.
I couldn't agree more, John. And I worry, as the studios move into the streaming future, that the theaters are going to not have enough product, that a lot of the mid-level stuff that we like, the Ford versus Ferrari kind of movies, that these movies are not going to even show up in theaters. If they get made at all, they're going to go straight to streaming. What are the theaters going to do? Live on Marvel alone?
Yeah, and who knows how many Marvel movies might end up on Disney's Disney Plus platform. It's going to be an interesting story to follow over the next months and years. Anne Thompson is editor at large at IndieWire, where she writes the Thompson on Hollywood column. And thanks so much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure, John.
Coming up next on The Frame, John Leguizamo might have missed his calling as a history professor. John Leguizamo has done a lot. He's acted on stage and screen. He's been a playwright, a filmmaker, and even a stand-up comedian. This year has been no different. He's getting ready to hit the road with his solo show, Latin History for Morons, starting right here in Los Angeles. And he's nominated for an Emmy for his supporting role in When They See Us, the Netflix limited series about New York's Central Park jogger case in 1989. Leguizamo lived in New York at the time and remembers the media narratives around the five youths, four black and one Latino, who were convicted even though they were innocent. But he said this dramatization offers a different perspective.
The beauty of When They See Us, done by Ava DuVernay, is that it brings you there. It makes you present. It makes you be one of the kids. It makes you be one of the parents, which nothing else could have done that. I mean, not all the news articles written about it, not the beautiful documentary by Ken Burns, which was one of the most masterful documentaries. I mean, because it really gave you the legality of it. But it didn't make you one of the kids or the parents like the series does. And even when I was reading the script, it was so painful. I would rehearse with my wife and she would read the other part. She would weep so much. I go, if you cried through the whole time, I can't rehearse with you because I can't understand what you're saying. That's how painful it was. And, you know, when it happened, I was not living in Manhattan. I was living in Queens. And so I just read what the paper said, you know, so I wasn't connected to the community. So I just believed that. I go, why would those kids do that? I mean, I was like, why would they go wilding out like that? Why are they giving us such a bad name? You know, that's kind of like what you felt if you just read the papers, if you weren't in the community and understood what was going on.
I think there was also a common belief that all five of the kids were black. And it was interesting to see that obviously your character's son is Latino And what was the reaction among the community about Raymond Santana Jr.? Because I think we all knew a little bit about how the African-American community reacted, but I don't even remember the Latino community and its reaction.
Right. Well, they were two Latin kids. They were six kids altogether, but one of the Latin kids was smart enough. I don't know how he knew not to confess to anything, wouldn't sign anything, and the parents didn't either, and he got let go. Obviously, you know, in the Latin community, a lot of people believed the media. You know, they believed the news, and so the Santanas were ostracized, even by their own family. It's like, why are you bringing this scourge into our family, into our neighborhood? You're giving us all a bad name, and you're wrecking our reputation here. And you know, Mr. Santana, by his own brother, was asked to leave. His brother was the superintendent, was asked to leave the building.
I want to play a clip from When They See Us. This is when your character comes in and sees not only what has happened to your son, but what he is confessing to, even though it's completely untrue.
Okay, so Antoine held her down while Kevin was raping her, right?
Wait, what are you talking about?
Pop, stop.
What are you talking about, rape?
Your son was witness to a rape in Central Park. So Antoine was raping her. Now, what were you doing?
None.
Come on, Ray. I mean, no one's going to believe a kid like you would just stand there. You got to put yourself in there.
No. Wait a minute. What do you mean, put yourself in there?
Stop.
He was
stop.
There. You didn't hear what he just said?
Stop.
A father is seeing his son admit to something that he can't imagine his son ever having done. And, of course, his son hasn't done it.
Right. I mean, and the amount of confusion in that poor father's head, I mean— Here are the cops who you're supposed to respect and believe. Here's your son who you know, and you know his character, and you know he's just a child. And he doesn't know what to do, and he's trying to weigh it all. And he's got to make huge decisions that are going to be life-changing for his son. And it was very difficult to do. You know, my scene was done at the end of the night, you know, at the very last. The poor kid, Marquise, playing my son, had to go through a lot of scenes, you know, where he's getting abused by the police. And I know he was exhausted and worn out, but he just, it was really painful to do these scenes, but important. You know, I mean, you have to, as an artist, sometimes make yourself go through the really painful things that are hard to shake after the fact. But you know you have to in order to get an audience to really be there with you.
This feels like a series not only about what happened, but about how the families of these children reacted and how they stayed together, for better or for worse, when they were confronted by this horrible miscarriage of justice. And it feels like that's very intentional in the series, that this is a story not only about how these kids were falsely accused, but about how their families dealt with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you, Ava, brought us into their world, you know? All the conflicts inside the families, you know, some of the parents turning against each other, just because out of fear, you know, a fear of losing their child, you know, forever. The community that we created, the actors, to be able to go to these places, these dark places, you know, we were nurturing to each other. Ava was very nurturing. We were very consoling to each other. Everybody treated each other with such kindness because we had experienced such violence in the scenes, you know.
I want to ask you about the real Raymond Santana Jr. There are these portraits of the Central Park Five at the end of the series, and they are very impressive-looking men. And I'm wondering, was it intentional to have any kind of contact with the real characters? Were you able to meet with them, or did you want to keep your distance?
Well, I'm very method, you know. I studied with Lee Strasberg for one day. my acting actually killed him, I think. He died that day, but I don't know if legend is that my acting killed
him.
Is
that a true story?
Yeah, true story.
He died
in 1982. I was 17 years old. So I've been method my whole life, you know, and method is, you know, you got to meet the people, you got to do research, you got to involve yourself. So, you know, I met Santana Sr. and I met Raymond Jr. and we went to dinner together. I took him to a really fancy restaurant. I felt that was the least I could do. And I just asked and talked and wanted to understand what were the thought processes that allowed Mr. Santana to sign that confession. And how did you live with that, you know? And the poor man, you know, he was a single dad. The mom was ill, they were separated, the mom was ill. And he had a lot of responsibilities, and he was afraid of losing his job. He was afraid of getting there late, and he knew his son was innocent. So some people believe just because you're innocent that somehow innocence is a shield against all evil, against evil intent. And he just thought that his son's innocence would come to light someday. And that's a lot to bank on, you know. I think the takeaway is don't confess to anything you didn't do. Don't sign anything and just ask for a lawyer. I mean, that's the takeaway that I walked away from that.
We're talking with actor John Leguizamo. I want to play a clip from your show, Latin History for Morons, when you talk about Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States.
Because even in the first chapter, he proves that our contributions were even bigger than what I thought. Because we also gave you tomatoes, potatoes, chocolate, try living without that shit, ma'am, hammocks, canoes, chili peppers, tobacco, anesthesia, brain surgery, and people from Jersey and Long Island, fucking hockey.
I think there is a real clear parallel between Latin History for Morons and When They See Us, and that is the history that we've been taught and the history that is true. And I'm wondering if you think about that as well, because last week, the New York Times published its 1619 project about the history of slavery in this country. And it feels like those two projects of yours, Latin History for Morons and When They See Us, are telling us the story that we should know and that we haven't been taught.
That's a really interesting correlation, because you're right. I mean, it's the things that we're not told about, the history that's sort of kept from us and erased. Because profiling Latin and Black kids the way they're profiled by the law and in job situations all comes from the fact that our history and the truth of our contributions to the making of America are not out there. And if the correct history was put out there that Latin and Black people were really instrumental in the making of the United States in so many different ways, then there would be a lot more respect to us, and we would be much more respected, and people would not be so bold as to, you know, tell us to go back to where we came from.
Coming up next on The Frame, more with John Leguizamo. Let's get back to my conversation with actor and playwright John Leguizamo. He's headed out on tour soon with his solo stage show, Latin History for Morons. The show's website offers a syllabus of sorts that includes a long list of books. But in order to create that reading list, he first had to do his own homework.
I mean, the genesis of the show was that my son was being bullied at school when he was 12 years old. And I couldn't believe that my son in New York City in these modern times is being racially profiled. And, you know, I was bullied as a kid, obviously. You know, there was a lot of white flight. We were like the second Latin family on the block. And, you know, when we played games and you beat them at stick ball or stoop ball, then it would turn into racial slurs. And I never had an answer, you know, except, I'll kick your, you know, boop, boop. But I didn't want that for my son. I wanted to elevate everything, and I wanted to be an evolved parent. And so I wanted to give him information and knowledge and data and facts about Latin people. And when I started reading all these books, I was like, wait a minute. I'm the one that's being empowered. I'm the one that's healing my sense of feeling like a second-class citizen, because all this information is so powerful. I mean, when I learned simple facts like Latin people are the second oldest ethnic group in America after Native Americans, that we're the only ethnic group that has fought in every single war America has ever had, and we're the most awarded. These are huge contributions to the making of this country. We shed blood for the making of this country. And for people to have the audacity to tell us to go back to where we came from, it's not being said to the French, it's not being said to the Irish or the Russians, it's only being said to us.
It sounds like you're talking about your show almost as a portable classroom.
Wouldn't that be great? I've had a little van, like a taco truck, and went around just doing my show.
You premiered Latin History for Morons at Berkeley Rep 3 years ago. And let's just say a lot has happened since then.
He asked why the United States should welcome immigrants from shithole countries. He was referring to.
And it will not be a refugee holding facility. Won't be.
Brutal week, just as the families of the victims of the El Paso attack were mourning those killed after what was the deadliest attack targeting Latinos in modern American history, a massive immigration raid on undocumented workers took place in Mississippi. We saw images of crying
yeah.
children.
What does that mean to the show? Does it change in its meaning? Do you change the words? How does it evolve as the country evolves?
Well, what's interesting is, obviously, the slings and arrows inflicted on Latin and Black communities didn't just start with this president, you know, with Trump. It was there before. He has just woke up the white liberal. I mean, he's done us a huge favor by waking up the white liberal. And it's a beautiful time in that sense, that we were all a little too comfortable and thinking things had really improved when they really hadn't, you know? And the things that my show has changed in those last 3 years is that obviously my attacks on Trump were really specific when I opened up on Broadway. They were very pointed, and I've changed them a little bit. I don't want to flip off the Trumpers. I don't want to flip off Republicans. I want to bring him into underneath my arms, you know. I want to open their minds and change their hearts. That's who my target audience is. I want to elevate my audience and show them how much we've contributed to America so they never feel like a second class citizen, so nobody can ever tell them to go back to where they came from because they made this country and they should never feel like they didn't. So I'm working it on different levels. I'm trying to psychologically disarm a certain group, and I'm trying to bolster and boost another group.
There are a lot of blackboards that you use in this show, and you draw a lot of charts and graphs and maps.
We're also 25% white, 25% Jewish, 25% Lebanese, and 40% I don't know what the f***. For a grand total of 180%, and that is us Latino people.
I want to ask you about the genesis of the show. Your first play was Mambo Mouth in 1991. What do you hope that this play accomplishes, and how would you define what it is you're trying to do when you do your one-man shows?
When I was at the Apollo Theater and I opened up the tour, this young Latinx young man, 19 years old, said I had all this rage and I didn't know what to do with it. Except tonight I learned what to do with it. I learned that knowledge is my weapon. And I was like, yes, that's exactly what I wanted this show to be. I wanted this show to trigger lots of Latinx kids into finding out about the history that is not available to them in their schools, not available in textbooks, not available on History Channel or Discovery Channel or a Ken Burns documentary. I point them to the books and the syllabus to study it and to empower themselves and weaponize knowledge. And that was my goal with the show. One-man shows to me, for the second part of your question, one-man shows to me is the most personal and intimate an artist can be with an audience. You know, it's my thoughts, it's my ideas, my philosophies, and the audience is responding intuitively with me, whether they're enraged, whether they're saddened, whether they're made proud by it. I mean, we are exchanging and they're very vocal. My audience is very vocal and they respond like, and it becomes a conversation.
You said something not long ago, and I'm going to read it back to you. You said, I grew up without seeing people who look like me on screen, on stage, or in textbooks. Latinx people have been kept out of the conversation for centuries, and it's about time y'all hear what we got to say.
Unfortunately, Hollywood has contributed to the sort of demonizing of Latin people because they constantly put us as drug dealers, as nefarious characters or subservient. And it's not the reality that I've experienced or I've seen. You know, I don't see the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or the Julian Castros in Hollywood movies. I don't see the two sisters Colombian twin sisters who discovered a chemical that can absorb the oil spills in the oceans. Where are those characters? Where are those positive images that elevate and change the narrative.
John Leguizamo has an Emmy nomination and stars in the Netflix series When They See Us. His solo show, Latin History for Morons, opens at the Amundsen Theater on September 5th. John, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a blast. What a pleasure. Thank you.
And that is it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.